is Outbreak News This Week, brought to you by the Global Dispatch Incorporated on AM 860, The Answer. Outbreak News This Week is your source for all the news about worms and germs. And now, your host, microbiologist and editor of OutbreakNewsToday.com, here's Robert Harriman.
Hello, Tampa Bay, and welcome to your source for all the news about worms and germs. This is Outbreak News This Week, and I am Robert Harriman. Well, starting tomorrow, Monday, on April 13th, the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine will be offering a free online course on vaccines. And I'm very excited about this, and I'm sure a lot of you will be also. The course, which I am signed up for, will be taught by a former guest on this show, Dr. Paul Offit. Now, the course is going to discuss issues regarding vaccines and vaccine safety, to include the history of vaccines, the science, the benefits, and the risk of vaccines, together with the controversies and common questions surrounding vaccines. And an update on newly created vaccines and recent outbreaks of previously controlled diseases will be discussed. Let's go ahead and take a listen to a short clip from Dr. Offit about the course.
In some parts of some countries, it means that, you can have your life saved, that you can live longer than before because vaccines save our lives. But in some parts of some countries, vaccines are a frightening thing. Some people are scared of vaccines. When they hear the word, it makes them think of, chronic diseases that they don't want to get. My name's Paul Offit. I'm chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and a professor of pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm going to try and help you understand vaccines. So what we're going to do in this course is we're going to talk about vaccines. We're going to talk about what they are. We're going to talk about what they're not. We're going to talk about how they work. We're going to talk about how they're made, whether they're safe, whether they're effective, so that you can understand them. So that you can understand them when you're trying to decide to give them to yourself, or trying to decide to give them to your children, or trying to decide to give them to friends and neighbors. So we're going to demystify vaccines. We're going to make it so that the fluid that's contained in that vial is something you understand well, so that when you make a decision about whether or not you want to give it, you'll be fully informed. We hope you enjoy the course.
All right. Well, if you're interested in taking this free 6-week online course, you can go to OutbreakNewsToday.com, and in the vaccines category, you'll find the posting about it, and there'll be a link to the University of Pennsylvania Coursera, where you can sign up for this course. It's very easy to sign up for, and it will be starting, as I said, on Monday, April 13th. Well, how many people do you know who have had diphtheria or tetanus? Probably none. That's how well vaccines work. Nowadays, people have a casual attitude toward diseases such as measles, mumps, rubella, polio, yellow fever, and Japanese encephalitis because they haven't experienced them. Well, Passport Health of Tampa Bay is a travel medicine clinic that specializes in all the immunizations you'll need before traveling internationally. It's risky to have a casual attitude toward these diseases because they are not extinct. In many parts of the world, they're common. If people stop getting vaccinated in the U.S., they would become common here also. Be on the safe side before you head out on your summer vacation or mission trip overseas. Contact Passport Health of Tampa Bay today to schedule an appointment with a travel medicine specialist and see what immunizations you need to stay healthy. Give them a call at 813-969-3757 or online at www.passporthealthtampa.com. That's 813-969-3757. Well, joining me now to talk about his recent appointment as a U.S. science envoy and the work he'll be doing is Dr. Peter Hotez. Dr. Hotez is the dean for the National School of Tropical Medicine at the Baylor College of Medicine, and he's the president of the Sabin Vaccine Institute. Dr. Hotez, welcome back to Outbreak News Radio Show.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Excellent. Now, you've been named as one of four U.S. science envoys by the State Department. What exactly are you and your colleagues being tasked to do as U.S. science envoys?
Well, so there have been about nine of us since 2009. So this was a program, the U.S. Science Envoy program, that was launched by the White House and the State Department back in 2009. And it began when President Obama went to Cairo and talked about a need for greater engagement with certain countries, especially the world's Muslim countries, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation Countries. And it really is based on the fact that one of the reasons why the world loves America is because of our scientific horsepower, our research universities and institutes. I mean, wherever I go all over the world, I meet top leaders in science who have done part of their training in the United States. And the truth is, we've not fully exploited that for purposes of our U.S. foreign policy. So it's an effort to have more engagement in science diplomacy and to bring full science into our U.S. foreign policy agenda.
Okay. Now, you, of course, are, many consider, a world-renowned expert in infectious diseases. And I saw an interview with you in the Houston Chronicle, and referencing the massive West Africa Ebola outbreak and the obvious shortcomings by a variety of agencies. And you said, we can't wait for catastrophic epidemics to happen and only then start making vaccines. We need to start anticipating the next threat. How do we do that?
So just to take a step back, so the science, this crop of science envoys, I'm the only one focusing on disease. The others are more focused on climate change and other aspects. And my involvement is an observation that we've been making here at our National School of Tropical Medicine, which is when you look at the world's catastrophic outbreaks of tropical and emerging infections, they're linked to two very important forces. They're linked to poverty and surprisingly, conflict. And the conflict piece is not something that many people appreciate, actually, nor the poverty either. But if you look at the real killer epidemics that have happened across the globe over the last 30, 40 years, many of them have actually happened in the settings where a country has undergone terrible civil war or international war, and with that breakdown in public health infrastructure, together with other forces such as human migrations and animal trafficking and deforestation. So an example is during the 1970s in Angola and Congo, more than 500,000 people died, more than 20 times in the current Ebola outbreak, but it went unrecorded because there were no journalists there to record it. They died from African sleeping sickness, which is transmitted by tsetse flies. Again, because there was no public health control measures that were continued during the hostilities. Then we saw it again in the 80s with the conflict in southern Sudan, where people fleeing the conflict were exposed to sandflies, and they got a terrible leukemia-like infection called Kala-Azar, and 100,000 people died then. So I would often point out that Ebola virus that happened in Liberia, Guinea, Sierra Leone, and West Africa this past year was really version 3.0 of a trend we've been seeing over the last few decades. And I've turned and I flipped that around to say, well, wouldn't it be nice if for once the world could be proactive? And rather than reacting to a situation, often reacting too late, why can't we try to predict where the next big catastrophic, cataclysmic outbreak is going to be? And what I've said is, based on this history of what I call conflict and contagion, I think it's going to be in ISIS-occupied areas of the Middle East and North Africa, in the Islamic State-occupied areas of Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Libya. These are going to be our next big global hotspots for a terrible catastrophic infectious disease. I can't tell you exactly what disease it's going to be, but I think that's where we have to look. And then you get to the problem, okay, well, what are you going to do about it? And I think one of my contributions is going to be focusing on building parallel infrastructure to what we have here in Houston, Texas, at the Sabin Vaccine Institute and Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development, where we're making vaccines in the nonprofit sector. We're making the vaccines of tropical infections of regional importance that the drug companies are not interested in making because there's no profit incentive. There's no market for these diseases, so we make them in the nonprofit sector and see if we can build a parallel infrastructure in the Middle East and North Africa.
Now, you did mention ISIS, and I'm curious of how would that work in such a with such a dangerous place? It's not like you could put people there.
No, absolutely not. Yeah. So, I mean, there's nobody, even the World Health Organization, is having a horrific problem getting access to that area. And so the only thing we know about the diseases that are emerging there are we get glimpses of it from refugees fleeing the conflict, pouring across the border into Jordan and Lebanon and Egypt and elsewhere. So the idea for building the vaccine infrastructure is we take one of the more stable countries in the Middle East and North Africa, and one preferably that has some semblance of scientific infrastructure, and try to build it out there. So for my role as U.S. science envoy, we're looking at three countries currently. We're looking at Morocco, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar. And each of those three countries have some promise for being able to adapt and create that kind of vaccine development infrastructure.
Well, based on the countries that you mentioned, clearly MERS must be on your radar.
Yeah, so MERS is one of the vaccines that we're making here in Houston, and I think that has a lot of promise, actually. And one of them that I'm very worried about in the ISIS-occupied areas of Iraq and Syria, but also Yemen, because the disease emerged out of the Arabian Peninsula.
Right.
So Yemen is ripe for a horrific MERS outbreak, and the world needs to respond.
Yeah, and concerning the ISIS, I've already seen some reports about leishmaniasis outbreaks going on over in one of their controlled cities.
Yeah, in fact, another name for leishmaniasis is Aleppo evil, because it's always been around Aleppo and elsewhere in Syria, and they've always struggled to contain it. But now with the total collapse of things in Aleppo, then forget it. The sand flies are proliferating, and we're seeing more than 100,000 cases of Aleppo evil, and very sadly, it's disfiguring the faces of a lot of little girls. That's going to render them unmarriageable and other terrible things. And we need a leishmaniasis vaccine, and that's one of the vaccines that we're working to develop here in Houston.
Excellent. And let me go ahead and close with this. Dr. Hotez, what other great things are you guys working on at Baylor and at Sabin?
Well, in addition to our vaccine development program, we have a human hookworm vaccine now in clinical trials in Gabon and Brazil. We have a new schistosomiasis vaccine that's now entered the clinic, so we're very excited about that. But we're also, being here in Houston, the Gulf Coast, we realized that with that link with poverty, we have a lot of poverty in Houston and the Gulf Coast part of Texas and the Gulf Coast. And so I've identified about half a dozen emerging tropical infections here that really no one in the past was paying attention to any appreciable extent. And so we're trying to conduct active surveillance on these diseases, trying to understand their link to poverty. These are diseases such as Chagas disease and toxocariasis and cysticercosis. I like to call them the most important diseases you've never heard of. They're actually quite common. It's just that they're most disproportionately affecting people living in poverty. And that's very frustrating because, during the Ebola outbreak in 2014, I think I was on MSNBC or Bloomberg TV or Fox News almost every day. And and the question would always come, doctor, aren't you worried about Ebola virus coming to the United States? And the answer was no, and here's why and what we know about Ebola. But I am worried about the fact that we have 12 million Americans now, mostly in the poor parts of the southern U.S., living with one or more neglected tropical diseases. And the response generally was, well, thank you, doctor, we're out of time. And so we really need to have a new, different type of dialogue about what diseases are actually here and affecting people, but we choose to ignore.
Yeah, Chagas is not quite as exciting as Ebola is, I guess.
That's right.
Let me follow up on that real quick, though. I think the last time I had you on my show, it was, late 2013, and the topic was Chagas, and you had some alarming numbers to talk about. How have things changed from that point until now?
So the disease is still there. We're uncovering some different types of vulnerable populations. For instance, our scientists in the National School of Tropical Medicine, Christy Murray and Melissa Nolan, have found it among the campers and hunters in Texas. because we have the kissing bugs there. We found it. They found it in the dogs. So, and that's important because one of the things that people are initially jump to a conclusion about is they'll say, well, this must be due to immigration. And I like to point out that the dogs are infected and the dogs are not slipping across the border from Mexico and El Salvador. We have transmission here of those diseases. They're getting picked up by blood bank screening. And now, as a result, we've got a clinic that's staffed by an infectious and tropical disease physician named Dr. Lila Wack Colburn. And so we're getting those patients referred. We're also now working to develop a new therapeutic for Chagas disease, actually a therapeutic vaccine to be used either as a standalone intervention or to be used as a companion with existing antiparasitic medication.
Great. Well, Dr. Peter Hotez, thank you, sir, for your time and expertise, and congrats on your new appointment.
Thank you so much. It's very exciting, and thank you for having me on.
My pleasure. Okay, well, let's go ahead and take a look around the world on OutbreakNewsToday.com and see what's making the headlines. And moments ago, of course, this is a pre-recorded show, and moments ago, the NIH just sent out a release and letting us know that that the American healthcare worker that was admitted to the NIH Clinical Center back on March 13th, who had Ebola virus disease, was discharged today in good condition after being successfully treated. And they say the individual is no longer contagious to the community, but that's pretty much it. They wouldn't give any more information about the patient because of the request of the patient. Now, this unnamed individual is the second Ebola patient that has been treated successfully at the NIH. The first one was in October of 2014, and that was Dallas nurse Nina Pham. Now, did you see this story? This is not something I covered, but I ran across it on CBSNews.com about this young mom who became partially paralyzed after getting an infection after sharing a makeup brush. And apparently it's a young mother in Australia, and she picked up MRSA, the methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, from borrowing her friend's makeup brush, and it has left her partially paralyzed. And her name is Jo Gilchrist, and she said she started feeling pain in her back. And back in February, it got worse than childbirth, she says. And then she lost all feeling in her legs and lower body and had to be airlifted to a hospital. And she goes, the only thing we can put it down to is the makeup brush, she told the Daily Mail. My friend did have a staph infection on her face, and I was using her hairbrush just before. I had no idea that that could even happen. I used to share with all my friends all the time. While the infection damaged her spine, and doctors were concerned she might never walk again. However, it appears like thanks to physical therapy and treatment, she is getting a little bit better. So very interesting story. I found that on CBSNews.com. Let's take a look at a cruise ship. Reports from the CDC's Vessel Sanitation Program says that there's a outbreak of an unspecified gastrointestinal illness that was on the Norwegian Cruise Line's Norwegian Pearl. And it looks like there's been about 114 sick passengers and crew. And they all had symptoms of vomiting and or diarrhea. However, it hasn't been confirmed if it's norovirus or E. coli or something else, but it is clearly a gastrointestinal outbreak, so we'll keep an eye on that and see if they... Now the ship went on a voyage on March 26th and completed the voyage and arrived in Miami earlier this week. And samples have been sent out, so we're waiting to see if we can find out if if or when we'll know what the causative agent is. So keeping an eye on that. Now, last week I talked to you a little bit about the concerns in the United States about ciprofloxacin resistant Shigella. Shigella, of course, is a bacteria that causes a gastrointestinal disease, and it's becoming more and more resistant. And a lot of that's due to travelers coming inside the United States and then bringing it with them. Well, apparently, the United States is not the only country dealing with this particular issue. And in an interview with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, Dr. Vanessa Allen, she's the chief of medical microbiology for Public Health Ontario, said the following: "We are aware of ongoing issues with resistant enteric bacteria, in particular Shigella. We have considerable cases of Shigella sonii, that's one of the strains, in Ontario, but much lower than in the U.S. Then she got into some more specifics. She says, for the five-year period from 2010 to 2015, 14% of the 663 cases of Shigella in Ontario were ciprofloxacin resistant. And she also mentions that many of them were Septra resistant, which is also a common antibiotic for treating that. And like I told you last week, the CDC put out a big report on this, and they were saying that, you know, they're looking at clusters of the disease in several states, and they saw ciprofloxacin resistance in nearly 90% of the time. So this is clearly an issue that health officials here and north of the border are looking at. Speaking of norovirus, there is an outbreak in New Zealand. Auckland Regional Public Health Service is reporting an outbreak of norovirus at the Auckland University, and that has taken down 168 students and staff. And keeping an eye on that, though health officials do say that it appears that it's getting close to being over. So, but 168 students and staff, that's pretty big. We've been at OutbreakNewsToday.com. We've been keeping a close eye on the canine flu outbreak that's going on in the Chicago, Illinois area. And there's been reports of, you know, 1,000-plus dogs being sickened by this, including 5 fatalities. Well, the CDC today or yesterday put out a statement concerning this. And it says, the CDC is aware of reports of canine influenza or dog flu in the Chicago area. Dog flu is a contagious respiratory disease in dogs that does not cause illness in humans. So they wanted to put that out. The dog flu is caused by an influenza A known as H3N8. And keep an eye on that. Keep an eye on what's going on in Chicago and Cook County concerning the dogs. Veterinarians are recommending that you get your dog vaccinated against canine influenza if you're up in that area. And let's go ahead and head into the break, and when we come back, we'll be talking about Lyme disease.
With SRN News, I'm Gordon Griffin. Republican Senator Marco Rubio expected to launch his run for the White House tomorrow. Plans call for the 43-year-old son of Cuban immigrants to make the announcement in his hometown of Miami. Earlier today, Democrat Hillary Clinton made her announcement to run for president in an online video. A spokesman for Senator Bernie Sanders says the Vermont Independent will decide by the end of the month whether to enter the 2016 White House race. In the meantime, he's urging newly announced presidential candidate Hillary Clinton to speak out strongly about what he says is wealth inequality and climate change. Sanders, who describes himself as a democratic socialist, has been drawing large crowds as he travels the country speaking on those issues and others. Attorneys for Saudi Arabia say that a judge should reject claims by families of victims of the September 11 attacks that new evidence shows agents of the kingdom directly and knowingly helped the hijackers. This is SRN News.
Just like us, Phil's gang is all about answers when it comes to investing in Wall Street.
When it hit that 173-point area, we knew it wasn't going to sell. We got a signal they're buying it back. They're putting money in. So here's all you got to do.
Don't miss Phil's gang. Weekday afternoons, 3 to 4, only on AM 860, The Answer.
What is it that we're really doing?
We're going to break an unbreakable Nazi code and win the war.
In the movie The Imitation Game, it's the outset of World War II, and the Germans have gained an early advantage. Allied supply convoys bound for England are being routinely ravaged by Nazi U-boats. And much of that deadly success is due to something called Enigma, an encrypting machine which enables the German military to communicate without having to worry about any messages being intercepted or understood. In response, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill deputizes a group of MI6 recruited codebreakers led by an eccentric math genius named Alan Turing. This handpicked team of savants have but one appointed mission: crack the Enigma's inscrutable codes. It's a race against time as the group of eggheads try to accomplish something every bit as important as the fighting that's simultaneously unfolding on the world's battlefield.
I like solving problems, Commander. And Enigma is the most difficult problem in the world.
No, Enigma isn't difficult, it's impossible.
Let me try, and we'll know for sure.
Based on historical fact, this Academy Award-nominated story of secrets and codes is a thought-provoking film. But it deals with far more than the early origins of computer science and the vital efforts in the midst of war. The film also examines the choices mathematician Alan Turing makes and the struggles he has with his sexual identity. And the fact that our Savior's name is misused at least twice, maybe three times, dampens the family friendliness. I'm giving The Imitation Game 2.5 early computers out of 5 for family friendliness. For other films out on DVD and full reviews of current picks at the box office, be sure to visit us at PluggedIn.com. And as always, don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Plugging you into the movies, I'm Bob Olszewski for Focus on the Family's Plugged In Movie Review.
Nice and warm with patchy clouds tonight, lows 73, partly sunny and a bit warm with a shower or a heavy thunderstorm, high 85 Monday. Mostly cloudy and a bit warm with a shower or a thunderstorm Monday night, low 72, partly sunny and warm with a couple showers and a thunderstorm into the afternoon hours Tuesday, high 87. That's your AccuWeather forecast. I'm Matt Roberts for AM 860, The Answer.
Welcome back to Outbreak News This Week, your source for all the news about worms and germs. Here's your host, microbiologist and editor of OutbreakNewsToday.com, Robert Harriman.
Hi, welcome back to the program. Been taking a look at California's West Nile situation from 2014, and the official numbers have come out. And, of course, California, we've been covering this on OutbreakNewsToday.com pretty thoroughly, and California was by far the state with the most West Nile virus, which is a mosquito-borne virus. And they put out their official tally for last year at 801, and that's more than double of any other state. I think Texas had the next most with like 350. Now, West Nile is always been a situation in California, and so this is not the first time California topped the U.S. as far as the most West Nile virus cases in the nation. I did a little research on this, And since reporting their first human case in 2002, California topped the country in cases in 2004, 2005, 2008, and 2011, and 2013, of course, and last year. And they've had nearly 5,000 total cases since that time in 2002. In fact, only Colorado has reported more cases. You know, as a matter of fact, in 2003, I just learned this, that Colorado reported almost 3,000 West Nile virus cases in people that particular year. I mean, that's just huge. We didn't even see that this year nationwide. I mean, 2014 nationwide, there was, you know, just a hair above 2,000 cases. So a lot of this has been attributed to the massive drought situation that's going on in California, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with that from the news and the situation with Governor Brown. So what does the West Nile situation in California look like for 2015? Well, the California Department of Public Health says it is not possible to predict the level of West Nile activity in 2015 because activity is influenced by many factors, including climate, the number and types of birds and mosquitoes in the area, and the level of immunity in birds to West Nile virus. Now, so far this year, West Nile virus activity has been reported in birds and mosquitoes in four different counties in California, and there's yet to be a human case. Now, in the world of infectious diseases, like any other field or specialty, there is some disagreement among scientists, among doctors, and among the public. In my experience, clearly the two most contentious issues, in my perspective, is vaccines and Lyme disease. Well, this week I received a press release that caught my eye, which announced that there would be a protest at the headquarters of the Infectious Diseases Society of America, or the IDSA, over their policies concerning numerous aspects of the ever-controversial Lyme disease. Joining me now is the co-founder of the May Day Project, a Lyme disease advocacy group. His name is Josh Cutler. Hello, Josh, and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Robert.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad to have you. Before we get into yours and other advocates' beef with the IDSA, just so my audience understands, what is the IDSA and what role do they play in Lyme disease guidelines?
The IDSA is the Infectious Disease Societies of America, and essentially what they're responsible for is it's a collective of all infectious disease doctors in the country and all throughout the world. They not only set the guidelines for Lyme disease, but for all infectious disease like AIDS, MRSA, etc. But they are responsible for authoring guidelines as a suggestion on how treatment should be followed, and in turn, doctors follow these guidelines, and insurance companies, in turn of that, follow these guidelines on what should be covered as far as what's deemed as treatment. Unfortunately, these guidelines are highly flawed.
Okay. Now, you and others want to protest the IDSA for a number of reasons, and you said that the IDSA's guidelines for diagnosis and treatment of Lyme disease harm patients who are routinely misdiagnosed and unable to obtain medically necessary treatment due to the restrictions imposed by the guidelines. Quote, we are uniting to demand IDSA stop its misrepresentation of science and its conflicts of interest and fix its guidelines for Lyme. In your view, what is wrong with the IDSA guidelines concerning diagnosis of Lyme disease?
As far as diagnosis, and this is something that they would openly agree with, we've been in correspondence with the IDSA president-elect, Dr. Calderwood, and he's agreed, unfortunately, diagnostic methods for Lyme disease are highly inaccurate and essentially a coin flip at best, depending on when you're tested for the disease. With Lyme disease being the great imitator, you know, mimicking multiple other diseases, it can be very, very hard to diagnose. So getting in correct time frame to treat is just unrealistic. So, you know, we're looking at, you know, and this is a rough estimate, from 50% to 60% rates where it can be a false positive or a false negative. So the CDC states that Lyme disease is a clinical diagnosis. And while I don't necessarily agree with that, we need diagnostic measures on top of a physician's clinical diagnosis. It makes it very, very, very hard to, you know, determine it. But with the fact of the CDC stating that there's 300,000 cases per year at least, and leading experts believe that that number could, you know, fly into the millions, it's definitely a problem at epidemic levels. So what we're trying to do is to, you know, get them to fund for more researching, for more research dollars to develop, you know, more accurate tests. That's just one of the things that we're trying to do right now.
Okay. Josh, you're a Lyme disease sufferer, I take it, right?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. How were you diagnosed?
I actually went undiagnosed for 2 years. I live in an endemic area in Loudoun County, Virginia, and I had taken, you know, two standard tests, and unfortunately it came back not positive, but I did have a stereotypical tick bite, got a rash, had the out-of-season flu during the middle of the summer, and progressively went downhill from being able to work at a highly functional level to, you know, not being able to get out of bed, and I was only 26 at the time. So I knew something was up, and I was told it was everything from MS to psychiatric to anything but Lyme disease, because my tests came back negative. But in Virginia, there's a lot of great minds that help get a bill passed that requires physicians, and I believe this is completely correct, but it requires physicians to hand patients documentation stating that if they test negative for Lyme disease, there's still a possibility that they still might have Lyme. So this is one of the only states that's doing that. But that's essentially,
Hey, Jess, so you weren't diagnosed by a laboratory test. You were diagnosed by a physician looking at your symptoms?
Well, no. Eventually what had happened is I'd come across what was considered a Lyme literate physician after comparing my symptoms to a lot of people online and just the endemic area that I live in. And saw a great physician. He didn't clinically diagnose me. There is a lab called Igenix that does run tests, but unfortunately insurance companies don't cover this and the IDSA doesn't accept it as standards. They're a little more sensitive of a test as far as the bands are concerned, but between that and a physician working in the area that's, you know, familiar with the symptoms, familiar with the area, going over medical history, you know, family history and stuff like that, we came to the conclusion that it was Lyme disease.
Gotcha. Okay. Maybe a more contentious issue between Lyme advocates and the IDSA is the treatment of Lyme disease. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So as far as the Mayday Project and myself personally, we don't have a stance on treatment. While I know that some would advocate for long-term antibiotics, we generally don't get involved in the treatment debate because I don't, unfortunately, think that there's enough evidence on either side of the fence to make a valid argument. While I do have friends and colleagues that have had success on long-term antibiotics, I personally have not. So it's a bigger reason for us to advocate and push the IDSA towards treatment or towards research, you know, regarding, you know, a better treatment or using drugs out there that might be more effective. But, you know, there definitely needs to be more research done that's not. And unfortunately, with it being such a large disease, it's the fastest growing and largest infectious disease in our country with very little research. So it's very, very alarming. But unfortunately, you know, like I said, it's not really something that we want to dance around. The IDSA, when you bring up the term long-term antibiotics, they're automatically turned off. So we've tried to take that off the table and get them to accept and put in their guidelines the idea of a persistent infection in Lyme disease. And that's honestly the biggest debate with Lyme right now is whether a chronic form of the disease actually exists or doesn't.
Right. Now, IDSA says, 2 to 4 weeks of antibiotics, I think, right?
Yeah, they do 2 to 4 weeks of doxycycline. Sometimes in some more severe case, they'll do a month of IV antibiotics, which is generally rare. But they believe after that point that you should be, you know, better. Anything after that is post-treatment Lyme syndrome, which is, I mean, that's a coin or a term that they've coined when they don't essentially have an answer for, you know, what's going on.
Okay. Now, I personally know people that have had Lyme and were treated just with a short course of antibiotics. I mean, that happens all the time, right?
Yeah. If it's caught early, And it's diagnosed correctly. I mean, if it's caught right off the bat, I mean, you see a lot of it in Connecticut, which you also see chronic cases. But if an intelligent doctor catches it, and sometimes they don't even use diagnostic testing, you were bit by a tick, here's, you know, your 2 to 4 weeks of doxycycline, then, you know, they generally recover and don't have to suffer. But there is a large number, you know, 30% of patients, you know, estimated are still sick after that initial thing. And it like I said, it comes down back to diagnostic testing and just lack of, lack of education with doctors.
Yeah. Well, and one of the big issues, of course, you already brought up, is the issue of chronic Lyme, where the IDSA denies there's such a thing. And, you know, since I put up that press release, I've had two or three comments about people saying, I have chronic Lyme, and they're very quick to come out and talk about it. I assume you're a chronic Lyme sufferer. What exactly is chronic Lyme disease?
Well, we personally don't use the term chronic Lyme disease. We believe that it is a chronic condition, but it's a persistent infection. And if you go to our website, themaydayproject.org, there's mountains of research that provide a case for a persistent infection. So what we believe is that if it's not treated effectively and properly at the very beginning, that that it can go into a chronic or persistent state. What, you know, and unfortunately, like I said, it's a very common thing. You know, where you have these spiral-shaped bacteria that get out of your blood, they can drill into tissue, you know, organs, stuff like that, and they can come out during a stressful or traumatic event. But again, we've got, I believe there's over 300 peer-reviewed studies that, you know, make a case for a persistent or chronic form of Lyme disease. So there's that. The biggest part of what it is when a patient becomes chronic, as we'll use the term, you know, they've seen a doctor, you know, they've done the 2 to 4 weeks of doxycycline. Generally, these are late diagnostic cases where people aren't diagnosed right away and aren't given antibiotics. And there are still some that are chronic that treat after the 2 to 4 weeks. I mean, it really, you know, it can vary, but the majority of cases are people that have been misdiagnosed or go on for a while to have the disease essentially decapitate in their body. So the majority of people will get, you know, a lot of symptoms that aren't the stereotypic, you know, arthritic symptoms. You get a lot of neurological problems, psychological. There's a lot of cardiac involvement. So as it gets into later stages, it becomes a lot more dangerous than the essential Lyme disease that you see, you know, when people have, you know, just arthritic issues.
Right.
So there's the biggest part of it is just getting that, you know, getting the persistent and chronic form of it accepted. And what the evidence that we have is the guideline authors are opponents that would say chronic Lyme doesn't exist. And this information can be found on our website, again, themaydayproject.org, that they've been in co-authored studies that show that there's evidence for a persistent infection in patients that have Lyme disease. So we're really perplexed as to why they continue to fight with us. And we know that there's conflicts of interest and we try to stay away from the legalities of that and any corruption that's involved. We just essentially want them to, okay, here's the research, accept this, you know, continue research if you're setting guidelines and realize the epidemic that this is. And that's kind of the standpoint that we're at with them right now. We've tried to work peacefully over the past couple of years. And when we do protest, we've been very cordial in dealing with them. And I believe that's why we've opened up avenues to be able to speak with their presidents and their boards. And as we speak right now, the guidelines are up for review. So, and that's something that's required every 5 years by the Institute of Medicine.
Okay. You talked about some serious allegations like conflict of interest. Is this... I mean, I can't think of any other reason why the IDSA would not listen to you guys better. You know, I mean, how open are they to your complaints, and how do they respond?
Well, honestly, you know, we approached Dr. Calderwood with the idea that we no longer want to share patient stories because, you know, we can sit and share stories of you know, mothers that you know, their families left them, and they have kids that have Lyme disease, and, you know, they've lost everything trying to treat this. And essentially they don't care because they don't believe that it's a real condition, you know, even though studies would suggest otherwise. So there's a lot of, you know, the conflicts of interest there. The same as the guidelines have been reviewed, they're being reviewed by the same people that have authored them. So that's a conflict of interest in and of itself. Now, this year, added 24.
Hey, Josh, let me interrupt you real quick, because you're talking about doctors at the IDSA, and the Lyme Disease Organization, is it iLabs or I can't think of that.
Yeah, iLabs.
Yeah.
That's correct.
And this is a group of physicians also, and how can they be at such a polar opposites on an infectious disease? I don't understand that.
Well, I'll be honest with you, and I mean, the only logical thing that I could think of is corruption somewhere. And, you know, generally we don't touch on that much because right. we want, if the IDSA comes out tomorrow and says, hey, look, we now agree, and mind you, all this information's out there that these doctors that haven't agreed with a chronic form are all on studies that are stating that there's a chronic form, and a lot of them have gone on record, and all the information is there and laid out. So what we're looking at is a pot, and it's right about to boil over. So you have a ton of very, very intelligent and brilliant doctors that are with ILADS that agree that a persistent form exists. Some are skewed on how we treat it because we don't have a cure, and unfortunately success rates aren't very high. But they're the ones that will take the patients that are discarded and told this is all in their head. So my only, like I said, my only assumption is when you have two camps that are in disagreement about this, one that's taking care of the patient, which, you know, all doctors have sworn to do, and then another that's completely ignoring it and telling us that it's in our heads or that we're a small number, you know, my intuition would draw me towards corruption and conflicts of interest. And, you know, all the information's out there. There's a great film, a documentary on Lyme disease called Under Our Skin.
Yes.
That can be watched for free. It was on Netflix for a while, but it goes in pretty deep as to where the corruption is. There was an antitrust lawsuit filed against the Infectious Disease Societies of America. And unfortunately, nothing really came out of it. But the fact that the state attorney general came out and saw that there was something that needed to be investigated, I think is big enough for people to try and dig a little bit deeper.
Oh, that was Blumenthal, right?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Well, I mean, it sounds like classic establishment versus the anti-establishment. I mean, that's where
right.
it sounds like to me. Well, let's get to your protest. Can you tell my audience more about the protest plans and when you're going to have it? And how can Lyme disease sufferers participate?
What we've been doing recently is we've been trying to protest and put pressure on the IDSA at specific points. Just recently in Philadelphia, back in October, we protested their ID week, where thousands of doctors come from all over the country. And we had a huge billboard truck out in front of there with Lyme sufferers as far as California coming into Philadelphia, just to, you know, open dialogue with these doctors and find out what their thoughts are and get feedback. And surprisingly, there was a lot of doctors that were there that were very, very open-minded and just basically said that they didn't know. The IDSA as a whole doesn't want us to protest. They've been very we paid to have passes to get into this conference and we're thrown out. You know, we were peaceful. We walked around. We weren't handing out any kind of literature or anything. They're well aware of who we are and what we do. But this has led into an annual protest at their headquarters in Arlington, Virginia. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that we've tried to do in the past is to have an open letter and go in and talk. And there's no real doctors at their headquarters. It's all VPs and essentially business suits that do a lot of the administrative tasks. But it's a central location that we can try and focus the news media on, you know, that we're there, that we're demanding answers, and that, you know, we're demanding some just, you know, people be put on the guideline panel. So we've got demonstrations. We have multiple billboard trucks that are out there. We're going to be running commercials that are asking the IDSA why they continue to reject science. Again, we'll have people there from all over the country that are flying in sick. And, you know, to Lyme patients, if you have the ability physically to get out of bed and to come, I know a lot of you are sick, just show up. You know, we have places for you to stay. We've rented rooms. We've made it as accessible to people to get as possible. We just need people to show up in force. And our hope is to, you know, eventually one day get thousands of people outside the IDSA doors and, you know, not leave. So we will be there for 2 days protesting. Wednesday night, I apologize, I don't have the dates in front of me. I'll have to pull up the press release. But that Wednesday night, we're holding a candlelight vigil for all of the victims of Lyme disease and those that we've lost this past year to the disease. We'll be doing, you know, just different memorials there. That's actually will take place on April 29th. Which is a Wednesday. Then we'll be protesting Thursday the 30th, and then the 1st on Friday. And we're going to be doing different demonstrations. I'm not sure if you guys are aware of the Lyme Challenge, which has been kind of viral. It was on the Dr. Oz show today. Celebrities all around the country have been doing it. But just to bring Lyme disease awareness to the country as a whole, we're going to be trying to get the largest Lyme disease challenge there. We're, you know, we're going to be dressed in hospital gowns.
Excuse me, Josh. I'm sorry. I'm running out of time here. The show's almost over. I need to go ahead and just, if people want to learn more, what's the website for the Mayday Project?
It's the maydayproject.org.
Very good. Thank you very much, Josh Cutler, and good luck with your situation.
All right. Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate your time.
You bet.
The following is an important health update from Passport Health of Tampa Bay. 1 in 12 international travelers will need to seek medical treatment for a pathogen while outside the states. Approximately 35% will contract traveler's diarrhea. Passport Health can help reduce your risk of contracting rabies and hepatitis, A, typhoid fever, yellow fever, and meningitis. The nurses at Passport Health will provide information and vaccines to protect you against the diseases native to the country you'll be visiting. Their nurses can also provide medications for travelers' diarrhea, malaria, motion sickness, and jet lag. Passport Health can also provide you resources on medical insurance to cover you on your trip. Call today, 813-969-3757. That's 813-969-3757. Or visit them online at www.passporthealthtampa.com. That number again is area code 813-969-3757.
All right. Well, if you want to learn more about the upcoming protests at the IDSA, if you're a Lyme disease sufferer, advocate, when this podcast is available after the show, I will go ahead and post the Mayday Project's website there so you can check out more about that. And I want to thank my guests, Dr. Peter Hotez and Josh Cutler, and I will see you again next week on Outbreak News This Week. God bless.
Thank you for listening to Outbreak News This Week with Robert Harriman. If you missed any part of today's program, you can listen to the podcast anytime on our website, 860theanswer.com. You can also find out more at outbreaknewstoday.com. Make sure to join us here next week at 5 for Outbreak News This Week with Robert Harriman on AM 860, The Answer.
Dennis Prager here, and in a recent speech to the United States Congress,